Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This time on Vet Story, we salute the incredible history and amazing men and women of the United States Coast Guard.
The Coast Guard personnel, people that have rescued lives since 1790 or at least back to the 1800s, are the ones that generally tend to go into a storm when everybody else is running away.
It was horrible. The sea conditions were terrible. It looks like you're going over top of mountains and going back down into the valleys, and this was a single screw ship.
So many other Coast Guard men and women who have gone in harm's way, some of them never to return, just to save the lives of others. So they deployed behind Japanese lines, and then all of a sudden realized the Marines had been ambushed.
Back in the 80s, our equipment and our technology wasn't as good as what the smugglers had. They would just blow right by us.
And as a rearguard action, Monroe actually covered the last boats as they were leaving with machine gun fire from his landing craft.
When you have the intimidation of a large cutter coming alongside and you have a helicopter and they're shooting your engine block out.
There was a quote back in the day when they used these surf boats, you have to go out, but you don't have to come back.
It's pretty much game over once that happens.
All right, on the phone with me for the podcast today is a man that has probably forgot more about the Coast Guard than most people will ever know, a Coast Guard historian, Dr. William Thiessen. Thank you for joining us on Vet Story.
My pleasure, sir.
You know what? I was really, really impressed and just flat out blown away that I didn't know more about the Coast Guard as I did research for our interview. And as we approach their 229th birthday, I wanted you to share with me today a little bit about a few of the legends of the Coast Guard and the stories behind them, beginning with what I might maybe call a founding father of the Coast Guard, Joshua James.
Certainly, yes. Joshua James was probably one of the most bemedaled, life-saving service hero of history, actually. He served until his death, actually. He died while he was on the job, and he was responsible for saving hundreds of lives out of his station at Hull in Massachusetts. And because of his incredible record of saving lives, the services actually honored him with the namesake status of one of its new national security cutters. But he was probably the most famous of all of the lifesavers in the history of the life-saving service, which was an ancestor agency of the Coast Guard, so hence the Coast Guard as well.
Getting to the 1800s then, when Joshua James was up there on the Cape of Massachusetts there, and looking at the seas, I don't know if he would have had the accent or not, if they pronounced
likely,
the, if they had the Oz back then. But he was guarding the ports and the waters around Boston, and he had a really interesting start to his inspiration for saving lives. Share with me that a young boy on the beach watching his mother.
Yeah, it's really a sad story that his family was involved in this aspect of the history of the service, but having lost family members, Joshua James was motivated to become the rescuer that he was, and he devoted the rest of his life to saving those who were imperiled on the oceans, and that occurred frequently there in his home location because many of the ships that were destined for Boston passed by his life-saving station. So with foul weather of various kinds, he and his crew would go out and save lives frequently every year. So he had established quite a record from the Hull station.
Yeah, and specifically going from the moment I was referring to there where, sadly, his mother perished, drowning right off the coast. And as a young boy, he saw that. He then dedicated his life to life-saving. By his early 20s, he'd already saved many people and was awarded a medal. Talk to me about that era of his life.
Well, at that time in his life, he actually was a member of the Massachusetts Humane Society, which was kind of a precursor to the life-saving service. And what was happening was that more and more immigrants were coming to the United States on ships of less than seaworthy condition. As you're probably well aware, Europeans were flocking to the U.S. In the early 1800s all the way up through the Civil War. And many of these ships, when they got to the shoreline, were unable to actually navigate through the waters without going aground. So hundreds were losing their lives on American seashores. So as a result, lifesavers like Joshua James had a whole lot of business. And eventually Congress decided to step in because too many lives were being lost. And the newspapers were showing on their front pages all of the carnage that was taking place. So as a result, people like Joshua James and others who were in life-saving service starting in the 1870s and on became great heroes and receiving the Gold Life-Saving Medal, just like Joshua James did. Many of them down in North Carolina, for example, became big heroes all the way up to Massachusetts. So Gold Life-Saving Medals were doled out pretty frequently just because there were so many great heroic rescues that took place. And they continue on today, of course, with the modern Coast Guard.
Now, he goes down in Coast Guard history as attending to one of the biggest rescues and really making a huge impact with one specific mission. Talk to me about the Great Storm in the 1880s.
Well, so he was involved with actually numerous rescues, I believe, during that storm. And in fact, it was almost an exhausting time because during this particular storm, it was practically one wreck after another that took place. And so he was actually manning the tiller to this surf boat on throughout the evening and into the daylight hours, trying to rescue shipwrecked and victims of shipwrecks from multiple wreck sites. So he must have been just simply running on adrenaline for many, many hours before finally completing all of the rescue. Certainly he was honored greatly for his efforts in this respect, receiving the medals he deserved. And to be honest with you, he served not only in that rescue, but he continued on into his 70s. And he died just stepping off a surfboat. And I think the last term he said was, "The tide is ebbing," and stepped off his surfboat after a practice run and passed out and died right there on the beach. So his whole life was dedicated to saving the lives of others up until his final breath.
Very poetic, as if to say the tide is ebbing in his final breath, as if like maybe saying he's also going out with the tide.
Precisely.
Wow, wonderful. Yeah. Share with me totals. You know, I've heard folklore say that he's the man that saved 1,000 souls.
Yeah, I believe the figure is probably somewhere between 500 and 1,000. I'm not sure that they ever have completely totaled up the statistics for his record. But certainly there are hundreds and hundreds of victims that owed their lives to him. And, of course, that equates to probably hundreds of thousands of descendants that are alive today because of his rescue efforts. And he's, like I said, he was probably the best known. In fact, I'm sure he was the best known of our heroic lifesavers. But not to discount the efforts of so many other Coast Guard men and women who have gone in harm's way, some of them never to return, just to save the lives of others. And probably should not forget those who have tried to help out those who are in peril on the high seas or in the surf to try to save their lives.
Indeed. And it's something I've been lucky enough to witness. Of course, I was in the Navy, and I recall being somewhere in the Northeast. I mean, I believe we were slated to be near Halifax, Nova Scotia, but I suppose we were closer to the States. But huge seas coming up, and I'm on a massive aircraft carrier, so I'm looking down at the open ocean and seeing what I have never forgotten, the size waves, just the chasms that opened up in the ocean. And I mean, literally, it looked like 10-story buildings. I mean, just so huge. And of course, we got a call that there was a ship in distress, and dispatched our SAR rescue swimmers. And I believe it was a joint operation with the Coast Guard, who actually went in and saved the people. I've never forgotten what that must be like to take a helicopter and drop in to those angry seas facing huge waves and be able to successfully pull someone out and get him back up to the chopper. But when I think about Joshua James, I think about doing this, several hundred yards offshore, but without any technology. What was he using? You say surf boats. What would have the chore or the task been like in the 1800s to get a ship or to rescue victims that had run aground on a sandbar or something like that?
So one thing I'd like to point out before I get started on that is that Coast Guard personnel, people that have rescued lives since 1790 or at least back to the 1800s, are the ones that generally tend to go into a storm when everybody else is running away. And that's the case today as well. Coast Guard personnel risk their lives, they go in harm's way to save others when usually people are trying to get out of the storm, they're going into it.
Hell yeah.
That's precisely what James was doing when he was saving these lives. But he would be on board typically a surf boat, which was launched into the raging and roiling surf on the beach. And it was an oar-powered boat at the time. They had no motors involved. It was all strictly by hand and sheer grit and muscle. A lot of times the surf, when they were launching into the surf, would be so horrendous that these boats, which measured in length probably 20 feet or slightly longer, would be launched up in the air and back to the beach, and they'd have to repeat the effort over and over again until they finally could get it to go through the surf. So this was no easy feat to try to launch these boats into the water. Certainly they were a little bit safer after they'd gotten out of the surf line because the breakers wouldn't be flipping the boat over. But it was very harrowing. And in fact, there was a quote back in the day when they used these surf boats that one of the keepers mentioned to a crew member is that you have to go out, but you don't have to come back. And that used to be the unofficial motto. Today it's not used because today we have much safer technology. But back in those days, it was all oars manned by human muscle, and just the only limit on your speed is how fast you can paddle that surf boat out to the shipwreck.
Mm, amazing. And how many crew on one of those surf boats?
There were at least six, but typically eight, and you also have a steersman in the aft, and he is generally the keeper. Who's in charge of the boat, and he would maneuver the boat, and generally he was the most experienced of the crew members on board, so he knew how to handle a boat. But, of course, the people that were the surfmen on board that were handling the oars were also expert watermen and knew how to maneuver boats in the surf, and that's something that the Coast Guard's been known for throughout its history, is small craft handling boats in shallow water and in surf. And that's in wartime and peacetime, actually.
Right on. And, of course, he continued to serve, was a keeper up until his 70s, and like you'd mentioned, dedicated life to the sea, and even after being, 60, 70 years old, took his last breath after a training mission, coming aground, coming ashore on the beach, and spoke the fateful words, "The tide is ebbing." Certainly a legend. Fast forward a few years, of course, into the 1900s, and we are looking at another incredible sacrifice, another incredible Coast Guard hero, and that is a signalman, Douglas Monroe. Share with me the story of his life and why he's recognized as one of the heroes of Guadalcanal.
So just a preliminary here, the Guadalcanal was one of the most honored Coast Guard military operations in its history. And there were many, many Coast Guardsmen who were honored with Silver Stars, Navy Crosses, Purple Hearts, all the rest, Navy Commendations. But Douglas Monroe stands out as the highest honored man in that campaign, Coast Guardsman. He started out as a radioman in the late 1930s, enlisted prior to World War II, but rose through the ranks really quickly. He went from basically your seaman recruit to a first class in just a few years. So it's really a recognition of the leadership that he provided for others. He was really embodiment of the Coast Guard's core values, which are honor, respect, and devotion to duty. He really was lived up to those perhaps more than any other in his unit. Anyway, he was assigned to the landings in Guadalcanal. And what the Coast Guard tended to do at Guadalcanal was to operate small craft to help the Marines. They would serve side by side, ensuring that the Marines had reconnaissance behind enemy lines using boats. They would also deploy the Marines in amphibious landings, but they'd also retrieve the Marines should they get in trouble. And so during one particular operation at Point Cruz, which is on the shoreline at Guadalcanal, I don't know if you're familiar with Chesty Puller, but he's a pretty famous Marine.
Oh, yes, sir.
Who went on to become a Marine general. Well, it was his regiment that went behind enemy lines. They were deployed on watercraft that were operated by the Coast Guard. And even though he is a signalman, Doug Monroe was such a great leader. He was also in charge of the flotilla that deployed Puller's regiment on the shoreline. So they deployed Puller's regiment behind Japanese lines, and then all of a sudden realized the Marines had been ambushed and were expected by the Japanese. As a result, they were incurring heavy casualties. Radioed to their command that they needed to be retrieved, and so Signalman Monroe immediately volunteered to lead that flotilla back to retrieve them, which he did successfully. Retrieving all of the Marines, including the wounded, off the beaches. And as a rearguard action, Monroe actually covered the last boats as they were leaving with machine gun fire from his landing craft. And he was killed by sniper fire as he was doing that. So he was actually recommended for the Medal of Honor by the Marines for his heroic efforts there. And it was later bestowed on him posthumously to his family, the Monroe family.
That's amazing. So he delivers the Marines to make the strike. Well, first, let me back up. They're in the Pacific Theater, which is
correct.
Which is the first thing I was surprised at. You know, I always thought the Navy and the Marines have this kind of symbiotic relationship where we travel and we take them everywhere they need to go. World War II, we actually brought the Coast Guard cutters with us all the way to the far islands of the Pacific to begin the campaign, which would eventually turn the tide of World War II.
You have to remember that the Coast Guard had a 250,000 personnel that served in World War II, operating vessels and whatnot. And I mentioned before that the Coast Guard's expertise is small craft, surf operations, and that sort of thing. So during 1942 and 43, many of the landing craft and small craft that were operated for the Navy were actually operated by Coast Guard personnel.
Okay. All right, so that sort of puts it into perspective. But then again, he's taking the Marines to Guadalcanal, which was one of the first battles of the Pacific, right? I mean, that was on our march through the islands to get us closer to Japan.
Well, you have to remember, that is the first amphibious operation conducted by the U.S. in World War II. It was really
First. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was really a laboratory for experimenting on different landings and amphibious operations leading up to other more. Well, Guadalcanal was quite famous, but other ones like D-Day became perhaps even more famous. But it was Guadalcanal that started it all.
So there we were testing our abilities to take a beach, testing our abilities to take an island via the surf, and of course Coast Guard's there. He brings the Marines to the island, and then when you say as they required extraction, he goes back, he volunteers for that mission. At the final moment where he really, really showed just this incredible courage, he was he manning the boat that was taking the Marines away, or did he surrender him or give up himself by taking a position in another boat with a 50 cal and just began firing at the enemies on the beach in order to give fire for the Marines to get out?
Well, it kind of requires a little bit of understanding of what a Higgins boat is to talk about that, because the earliest landing crafts in World War II, everybody who knows anything about the war knows that landing craft basically had an armored ramp that lowered in the front of it so that it could deploy troops and equipment.
Like the famous pictures of D-Day. Yeah.
Precisely, yeah. Right. But the earliest Higgins boats that were used for amphibious operations did not have that ramp in the front. In fact, what they really had were two dual machine gun tubs that were mounted in front, and the troops, such as the Marines, were required to deploy off the side of the landing craft. So if you go back to your history books and take a look at the earliest landing craft of 1942, they had these Higgins boats with no bow ramp, but with two gun mounts in front. Well, what happened was that when Monroe was leading this flotilla, he and another crew member were manning the 30 caliber Lewis machine guns in front of the Higgins boat. And when the Marines were being redeployed and taken off the beach, he, with this machine gun-equipped Higgins boat, was providing covering fire. So he was one of the last. His was one of the last landing craft to leave, because they were basically a floating machine gun mount to cover the retreat.
And just facing fire from the beach, facing enemy gunfire, he rather than trying to turn and take the troops and get them out of there as quick as he could, decided to give up himself and fire back. And that's, of course, when he made the ultimate sacrifice. Wow. Amazing. Let's talk about another fighter. Not necessarily a war fighter in combat per se, but a fighter for justice, a fighter for equal rights. Dr. Olivia Hooker plays an important part in Coast Guard history. Share with me her incredible story.
So Dr. Hooker, actually, you have to go back before she actually became a SPAR in the Coast Guard. She actually lived in Tulsa during the Tulsa Race Riot. She was actually the last surviving person when she passed away here just last year of that tragic event in Oklahoma. Her family moved away from Oklahoma and moved to Ohio.
If I could, real quick, I'll just stop you there and just note that, the race riots at Tulsa, 1920s, were a period in time. It's very dark in our history, and we don't hear much about it, but it should be noted that racial division was so large in the 20s that at one point in time, there was some sort of crime that had happened. An African-American had been incarcerated, and people had thought that the crime was so vicious that the whites of Tulsa turned on the blacks, went into what was arguably a very successful part of Tulsa, and just started looting and burning African-Americans' homes. And Klansmen went into the neighborhoods and searched, you know, for African-American citizens. And it was just a horrible incident where lives were lost. Dr. Hooker, as a little girl, hid so that she could escape the persecution and escape these Klansmen. And eventually, as you'd noted there, they moved to Ohio. And then, you know, she grew up with this kind of experience, you know, deeply defining her personality and deeply defining who she was. Share with me then, of course, how she gets involved with the military and the Coast Guard.
So she finishes up a degree at The Ohio State University, and she gets a job as a teacher in Columbus. And she just is teaching there for several years, and is really almost in her middle age by the time World War II rolls around. She decides that she wants to do her part to serve her country. And so she enlists in the Coast Guard, and she is one of five African-American women who enlist and become what they call SPARs, which was the Coast Guard's Women's Reserve, kind of like the WACs and the WAVES for the other services. And so she trains and becomes a yeoman, and she processes the papers for all the personnel associated with District 1 in Boston. And you have to remember that up through World War II, the military was segregated. And so African Americans, other minorities, were relegated to non-authority positions in the officer and enlisted ranks. And it wasn't until the war that there were efforts to try to desegregate the military. And the Coast Guard, of course, led those efforts, which ultimately resulted in the desegregation of the military right after the war by Harry Truman. But so Olivia Hooker had to deal with institutionalized segregation, but she succeeded becoming a yeoman. And so she was responsible in large part for processing out a lot of the service members coming back from European theater, from the war in the Pacific. And a lot of these service members had stories to tell. She indicated how much it really affected her to help these service members get back home and deal with PTSD and a lot of the issues that they had when they came back home.
Yeah, which is kind of shown in and really reflected in what she went on to do after becoming a member of the Coast Guard and an actual petty officer in the Coast Guard. She went on to get a PhD in psychiatry, and I guess I would imagine that was probably inspired and useful as she helped people deal with PTSD, although we didn't even call it that back then. But, you know, through using psychiatry and really achieving a PhD at a time when hardly any African Americans were even allowed to be in college.
Precisely. She was a trailblazer. Not only was she the first African American woman to don a Coast Guard uniform, but she also really broke color barriers after the service in her chosen field. She became a professor at Furnham University, and she didn't retire until she was 87 years old. So she served not only her country, she served her community, and she served her country admirably and honorably. Again, I bring to your attention the core values of the Coast Guard: honor, respect, devotion to duty. And she lived up to those in such a great way. She passed away at the age of 102 after doing so much to help out her community and the people around her.
You know, we love those trailblazing stories because even today, 2019, you know, we're still hearing about firsts in the military. But to be one of the firsts is not only a testament to the great work of Dr. Hooker, but how the Coast Guard was progressive in that respect decades before the rest of the services. So another great moment to be a Coastie. Dr. Thiessen, man, I really appreciate going through the history of the Coast Guard with you, and I thank you very much. Just bravo, shipmate. Job well done.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Now, as we just heard from the Coast Guard historian, Dr. Thiessen, and we heard about the epic history and the all-stars of the Coast Guard, it dawned on me that there's a family friend that I happen to have that spent his entire career with the Coast Guard, retired Coast Guard Lieutenant Commander John Hartlove from North Carolina. He's on the phone with me now, and John, welcome.
Hey, Phil, how are you?
I'm good, man, I'm good. And you know what? I've been doing all this Coast Guard research, and as you know, I'm a Navy guy, so... You know, we've always had what I considered kind of a seafaring rivalry, but man, am I impressed, and just God love you for the amazing things that the Coast Guard has done since 1790.
Well, that's okay that you're Navy. My dad, he was retired Navy, and my father-in-law was retired Navy, and my brother actually served in the Navy for 4 years, so, you know, the Navy and the Coast Guard, we got a little rivalry there, but we tend to get along okay.
Well, I'd like to think we're the smarter branches of the military because we chose to be stationed at the beach. And, you know, you can't go wrong there. But what I really love thinking about and hearing about are the real stories. And while I've heard them from the historical perspective from Dr. Thiessen, I wanted to get from you... Share with me just a moment that you might never forget when it comes to rescue missions.
Well, one rescue mission that comes to mind, when I was on my first cutter, I served on six different cutters. I did 16 years at sea. There was one case that we had. We were 200 miles off the coast of Montauk, New York, and there was a vessel trying to make the trip from New York to Bermuda, and their fuel tanks became contaminated, and we were called to go out there and get them, and it was a terrible gale blowing during that time, and we get a couple hundred miles offshore, and seas are 30 foot, and we were just getting pounded out there. And the vessel was disabled. We needed to get the people off. It was too rough to get small boats in the water to go over and pick them up. We ended up the next day calling helicopters out to pluck them off the boat. Our chief boatswain mate had gone over there, broken his arm trying to help. It was horrible. The sea conditions were terrible, so bad that they had to fly helicopters out to pull the people off. And that was one that really sticks in my mind because it was probably some of the worst sea conditions I remember. And this ship is only 205 feet long, so you're just a speck out there when the sea conditions are like that.
Yeah, talk to me about that a little bit. I mean, to me, that sounds like a pretty big boat. But, of course, having been in the Navy, I know ships, you know, are, you know, 1,000 feet long. So what does a 30-foot sea look like to a 200-some-foot boat? Like
it looks like you're going over top of mountains and going back down into the valleys. And this was a single-screw ship. You know, it was a old Navy fleet tug, which was designed for, you know, tugging ships and boats and barges, and we were using it, you know, as a Coast Guard cutter. There's really, we didn't have a lot back then. This was early 80s. So it looks like there's just mountains of water coming towards you, and then you just slowly ride up over it and then back down. And the folks that were on that little yacht that was trying to get to Bermuda, I felt really bad for them. They were just getting knocked all over the place.
So the movies kind of get some of it a little bit accurate when they show you going up the face of that thing and you're almost expecting just to go completely backwards at some point. I mean, like
you know, you keep your nose into the seas and so you're riding the seas well. You don't want to get catching the waves broadside, that's for sure. And if you start getting breaking waves, it can get very dangerous. So you've got to be aware of that at all times.
Amazing. Yeah. Now, not only were you life-saving, but you were life-saving in a different way through the law enforcement capacity. And I know oftentimes you guys are saving us from dangers we don't even know about. But I'm talking, you know, I'm talking about drugs. I'm talking about the coke and the smoke that's, you know, coming through the American ports. It's responsible on a secondary level to a lot of lives lost due to street crime and due to, you know, all kinds of nastiness. I can only imagine how dangerous some of those runs are. When you encounter the, you know, the smugglers and the cartel guys, do you have any stories about drug interdiction when stuff almost went sideways or something that really stands out in your memory as just being one hairy experience?
Well, from my perspective, being on the ships and doing it for so many years, like I said, back in the 80s, our equipment and our technology wasn't as good as what the smugglers had. They would just blow right by us in their go-fast boats, and we couldn't catch them. And then finally, as we got better equipment, started carrying helicopters on board, the helicopters were armed with 50 cal snipers. We could launch a helicopter, get alongside these go-fast boats that would be running between South America, Dominican Republic, you know, all the Caribbean countries there. We could cut them off, and they could effectively shoot their engine blocks out with a nice 50 cal round through the engine block and stop them dead in their tracks, and we could get them. We also worked closely with the Navy. They had P-3 Orions up above searching for us at all times, and DEA, they worked closely with us, doing all kinds of little secret things to help us pinpoint where these guys were and catch them.
Now, when you went alongside, though, like when you finally did get one, or as the technology kept up and, you know, the war on drugs in the 80s ramped up, what was that moment like? I mean, you guys, you guys had to fear that any moment they could pop up out of below deck there, out of the hull, and they could just start shooting back at you guys, right? Because they didn't want to give up their coke. They didn't want to give up their ship.
When you have the intimidation of a large cutter coming alongside and you have a helicopter and they're shooting your engine block out, it's pretty much game over once that happens. Now, I was a federal boarding officer for many years at a small boat station, Clearwater, in Florida. And I did a seven-year combined tour there. I did two different tours there. And that was a SAR station, but we did a lot of law enforcement. And you'd be surprised, you know, how the drugs close to home can get into ports. And so we'd have to stop drugs from getting in into the U.S. close to home. A lot of that takes place and people don't realize it. But you're right. You know, we would do fishery patrols where you'd board fishing boats and you never knew who was on board. But there's techniques when you go alongside and you board the vessel, and once you get on board, you find their weapons, you get the crew in one place on the boat, ask them where their weapons are, you locate them, and then you basically remove them from where they're used to them being. You hide them so they're not a threat anymore. And when you come on with, you know, 4, 5, 6 boarding officers, they're not going to mess around. Most times, by the time you get on board, they're pretty compliant. There are times when they're not, but, you know, it doesn't last long.
Yeah, no doubt, man, no doubt. What's the most amount of drugs you've ever seen? Let's talk coke. What's the most amount that you've ever seen busted at once?
Oh, gosh. You know, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but I will say this. Over the years of doing it, each bust was bigger and bigger and bigger. And what was really alarming was some of the more recent ones I did before I retired from the Coast Guard. There was heroin mixed in with the cocaine. Like, you'd get tons and tons of cocaine, and alongside that, there would be packages of heroin, which we hadn't seen before for many years. And years ago, it was more marijuana than anything, but you start seeing heroin coming in. That was really concerning. I remember that specifically. But we would get extremely large busts. I mean, there were tankers that were carrying it on board. It's very hard to locate sometimes. I remember specifically we had a case off of Ecuador. We went through the Panama Canal. We were patrolling down there, and we boarded a vessel, and there was unaccounted for space, and we were on that boat for 3-4 days getting approval to access certain areas to confirm that the space was accounted for. And we eventually did locate some drugs. But all those scenarios, you know, you're out there in the middle of the night, rough weather, it doesn't matter what time of day it is, you come across a vessel, you're going. And it was it was a very exciting job. You know, like I said, the Coast Guard is so small. You know, I was a machinery technician, but a collateral duty, I was a boarding officer. So not only did I have to do my regular duties, but in addition to that, you know, standing my watches and everything, I had to be ready to be a boat engineer or be a boarding officer or part of the boarding crew to enforce all federal laws and regs. There's never a dull moment, I'll put it that way.
Did you ever find drugs in like a weird situation, or did you ever find smugglers like doing like kind of undercover in a way you didn't expect? Like, I don't know, a man and a woman and she's pregnant, turns out her belly's, you know, a belly full of blow, or a stuffed animal.
I personally never ran into that. There were scenarios where there was one experience that I had where we ran into one of these submarines that Colombia was using, one of the Colombian cartels, and we pulled into Cartagena, Colombia, and they actually had the submarine there pulled out of the water, and we could look at it close up, and it's amazing what these guys will do, the risk that they'll take to get these drugs to the United States. These things are just, looks like a fiberglass tube with an end on each end of it, and a snorkel so they can breathe, and they pack that thing full of drugs, and the risk they take is unbelievable.
Talk to me about those things, because I know that we just saw the viral video that was out of the Coastie that jumps from the fast boat onto the top of it and is like banging on the hatch while this thing's speeding through the water. I mean, one of the coolest, greatest moments I've seen since the television show Miami Vice.
Yeah, but open up.
I gotta wonder, man. Inside those, you've been up close and personal with one of those semi-submersibles. I mean, they're not full submarines because I know they don't go fully underwater. But
right. The
risk that the crew, that the drug smugglers are taking, I mean, it's almost insane, right? Because couldn't they die just trying to get from the island to Florida? I mean, just traveling 30, 40 miles in that thing. Could they die just trying to make the trek?
It's always dangerous at sea that anything could go wrong. And, you know, these are home-built submarines that And the way I understand it is they would build them. Most of these were built in Colombia. They build them back in the jungle up a river where they can't be seen. And some of the folks that are bringing the drugs over are forced to do it. And, you know, it's do it or die. So that's why they take the risk. And, you know, that explains that part of it. But and crossing the Caribbean Ocean in a little fiberglass tube, I it's just crazy. But like I said, if somebody puts a gun to your head and says, look, you're going to take this across or your family's going to die, then...
Yeah, no doubt. It's a third world country, and it's a total mess down there. And it's
horrible.
You know, it's a never-ending problem. I don't think the war on drugs is ever really going to be over. I guess what I was getting at is, like, what do they do with the exhaust? You're in a tube with an outboard motor. I mean, what the hell are they?
They just have, like, a snorkel going out, you know, that carries the exhaust out. It's real primitive. It's real crude. I'm sure it's got to be horrible conditions inside of this thing. And, like I said, the Caribbean Ocean is a pretty big area to cover on a ship, and I just cannot imagine, you know, trying to cross the Caribbean Sea with something like that. It's just
crazy. How many days would it take, do you think, to get from Colombia to Florida in one of those things?
I would say at least 5-6 days, at least.
Holy cow!
And they're not necessarily going to Florida. A lot of times they'll leave, and there may be a vessel that meets them halfway across to refuel them. That happens a lot with these go-fast boats.
Mm.
They'll meet them partially, you know, and we've come across those boats, and they got all these drums of fuel, and they're telling us that they're out there fishing when you ask them what they're doing, and it's, you know, one guy with a fishing pole, and you're like, you're all the way out here in the middle of the ocean, and...
and you got 200 gallons of fuel, and you had one fishing pole.
Yeah, but a lot of times they're just trying to get it from point A to point B, and then it hits another vessel, and it goes from there to another one, you know. And they're very creative, you know. Whatever they end up getting caught with, they shift to something else. I guess the sad thing is there's such a demand in our country, they'll do anything to get it over there.
Yeah,
and that's really what we need to stop is the demand for it.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt there. Just on a final note, a lot of us vacation down there. Or we go on cruises or we travel to the Caribbean. We go to the Bahamas. As I look out over the Caribbean from my hotel room balcony or from the cruise ship I'm on or from the beach there, and as I look out over that great ocean, just how many boats are carrying drugs, do you think? I mean, like, you've been out there. Is it a huge percentage of the ship traffic out there or the boat traffic is up to no good? I mean, are we?
No. It's not a huge percentage. And it's very orchestrated when it is being done. The amount of vessels that are out there all the time, doing regular merchant type work in comparison to the folks that are running drugs, is there's a huge disparity between the two.
Hmm.
I would say it's a pretty small portion of the vessels out there that you're going to see if you're out there on a cruise ship. But you never know. I mean, you never know who you're going to come across.
You guys are the ones that can find the needle in the haystack, and I think that's why I wanted to ask the question, is just show how difficult of a mission it is, how dedicated the sailors are that do this, and just how much ass the Coast Guard kicks, man. I really appreciate it, John. You know what? We've never shared this, although our families have known each other for years. But I just wanted to say, man, thank you so much, man, for the honor, commitment, and selfless dedication that you guys have shown over your entire career, and for that matter, for 229 years now. Since you guys have been the U.S. Revenue Cutter Service and the U.S. Life Saving Service, man. Go Coasties!
That's it. Semper Paratus, baby.
Semper Paratus. Oh. Yeah, leave me with that. What is the motto and what does it stand for?
Always ready.
Always ready. Awesome, brother. Hey, man, really appreciate you, Commander. Thank you for your time.
No problem. Thanks a lot for the call.